Okay, anybody have any comments or questions?
I just wanted to make a comment. It's really interesting that as I like I've read these scriptures before, but today it is almost like I'm seeing it from like different eyes. I don't know. I'm like kind of blown away here. But I wanted to comment about what the churches teach, which obviously is a false doctrine that the believers are going to be taken away, right? But we know that they're not the believer, because it says here that it's the non-believers. So that's kind of that kind of puts a little bit of like fear, you know, like where it's like, oh, you don't want to be taken because why would you want to be taken? That's not a good thing. So yeah, I just wanted to say that.
But how do you know that those people there are non-believers, Shelby?
Well, would it be the vultures? Because the vultures are going to be, or is that dead people?
Well, okay, I'll just cut to the chase here. In Luke 17, when Yeshua is speaking, he is talking about the situation of the time of Lot and the time of Noah. And who was saved in the time of Noah? It was the believers. Who was saved in the time of Lot? It was believers. So then from that, you can now extract and extrapolate that those who will be saved in the coming of the Son of Man will be believers. What happened to the unbelievers in the days of Noah? They were killed. They were taken. What happened to the unbelievers in the day of Lot? They were killed. They were taken. Therefore, you can extrapolate that in the day of the Lord, in the day of the Son of Man, that the one who is taken is the one that will be killed, and the other one will be left or saved. And in our day, we're also looking for in gathering. So the one that is left will be the one that will benefit. The one that is taken will be the one that will be destroyed. Does that make sense?
Yes, that does. And you have a really good way of laying it out. Sometimes I really struggle with the bigger picture aspects of things. So I really appreciate you explaining that.
Okay, Joanne?
We see the truth of our day and what's going on before Messiah's return, eating, drinking, carrying on. In many ways, that is known as cognitive dissonance, meaning that we can't quite believe it. Our life is something else, and we can't really believe what's happening. We're seeing death being unfolded with a virus and with its supposed antidote, but we can't quite believe it. So we want desperately to cling to what we consider quote unquote normal. And that is what they were doing in Noah's day too. In a greater way now, we're far more guilty because we have such knowledge of Jesus, God, the Bible. And so our cognitive dissonance needs to be washed away with the truth more than ever. In Noah's day, they didn't have all these wonderful resources. So they could go see a boat being built and Noah had a word or two for them, but they could easily return to their lives and what was normal to them.
I'm going to suggest here that the coming of the Son of Man will have a same kind of technological component that the days of Noah and the days of Lot had. The days of Noah was the beginning of shipping. He was the first captain of a ship. That's technology. The days of Lot, we now have seen in World War II, that kind of destruction that literally rains fire and brimstone from heaven. We have seen that in the H-bomb and the nuclear bomb. I'm going to suggest to you, because it looks like in Luke 17, 34, 35, and 36, like there is going to be some kind of supernatural thing that happens that did not happen as the result of technology in the days of Noah and Lot. What might that be? Well, I'm going to suggest, and it just hit me even just this morning, that the technology that is going to, it'll be reversed. Okay, this time the technology will be something that does something to those that are taken. It's Yahweh is going to use this technology against mankind. I'm going to suggest, and it's just a suggestion because it came to me this morning. I don't know if it came from Yahweh or was just my own thought, but this vaccine has in it an ingredient called graphene oxide. Graphene is a liquid metal, and it is a coating that causes something to be able to receive instructions. It's for connecting between, I'm going to suggest, 5G and the human body. Could it be, and I don't know, we'll have to think about this and pray on it. Could it be that the interfacing between the 5G and the one that has taken the vaccine is the one that's going to be killed, and the other one that has not taken the vaccine is going to be left? I'm asking the question, what does anybody think about that?
I think that is interesting, yeah. But as you're talking, Kimberly, I was thinking for a minute too. I know that they have some type of technology that can like lift people off the ground too. I don't remember where I researched that, but it has to do with the Project Bluebeam stuff. And so for some reason, I was thinking as you were talking, and it could be my own thought here, but what if like that technology that can like lift people off the ground is also connected to the 5G too, and could really hurt people too?
Yeah, that's a thought. That's a good thought. Joanne?
I know that you have published a Beast Watch News about it and several aspects of this vaccine and its progress to reveal how awful it is. But you also did a Beast Watch News on forgiveness if you've already taken it. So where would it fit in that once 5G really rolls out, that the magnetic, or the graphene oxide in a vaccine can be reversed so that the forgiveness now kicks in? It's real scary.
It is scary, and I don't know the answer to your question, Joanne. The people, I get emails from people still. I'm still getting emails from people asking if they're doomed because they have taken the first injection. And I send them over to that article that you mentioned about the forgiveness of unintentional sin. But one of the things that I have said to them is that you're in a dangerous place because, in the very least, having taken the vaccine means that you have at least a heart to walk down that road toward enslavement to Satan. And so how much of that is in their body? I'm wondering, Joanne, if the reason for shot number two, shot number three, and the booster shots and all the additional shots that are coming, maybe because until they finish changing you into part human, part machine, that they have to keep injecting more graphene in you because it's weakened or you excrete it somehow. And that's, you know, they're boosting it. They just keep boosting it. You understand? Because this is a process. And at the very end, in Revelation 9, where the verse, is it verse 6, I think, that talks about that they're going to be feeling like they're being stung by scorpions. And I said to Michael this morning, you know, if you're being stung by scorpions, you can run away. But these people can't run away. For 5 months, they're going to feel this inside their bodies because they cannot run away. This is the final stage of changing people from completely human to now transhuman. And it's going to be painful because the nanobots are going to be taking out parts of your body and organs and muscles and I don't know what all, and installing machine parts. And, you know, the machine parts and your own natural bodies will have to be melding together. And it's going to hurt. It's going to be like having surgery without anesthesia. Comments? Questions? Go ahead, Joanne.
Is that also the section where they can't die? They want to die and they can't?
Yes. Yes. And that is, I sent on the in-gathering, I sent a, yes, it's in verse 6. In those days, men shall seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to seek to die, and death will flee from them. What was I saying? I can't remember. But yes, that's where it says that. And I sent a link about the Hydra Linai, or Linear, however you pronounce it. It's from the Hydra vulgaris natural little microscopic being. They have now synthesized Hydra. Now, what does Hydra do? Well, listen to that that man. He's a doctor talking about Hydra, but it has a component of immortality about it. That they're now putting this in the vaccines. This is, I don't know if this has been in the first and second shot, or if they're now putting it in the next phase of shots. I didn't get that information from there. But this thing is designed to introduce immortality into the shot.
I think it makes sense that it would be later shots because the experiment and the testing is to see who will die, get sick, have terrible life-threatening consequences. in the first two shots. So there's a test period, and the goal of depopulation, I think, would be in the first little bit. And then if you're going to introduce immortality, you want the good guy, you know, the devil wants his guys to survive and now be immortal. So it seems sensible that would be in later boosters, but it's very gray and scary when you have family that's done it.
Yes, and I'm with you. They're not really going to give the immortality component to the useless eaters. You know, everybody in this room here online is, according to the New World Order, we're useless eaters. We need to be culled from the herd. They're not going to put that in our shots. I think the ones that will get the shots are those that, with the immortality component, will be those who are part of the New World Order, and it will cause them to suffer. The rest of us will not. The rest of the population will not. And of course, our immortality comes through Yeshua HaMashiach. Anything else? Okay. I want to go back to Genesis 18. And I want to show you what I believe, and I'm going to submit to you that a lot of this is going to happen at Passover. For years I have said that Passover is the halfway mark. It's actually from Purim to Passover. Passover comes 30 days after Purim. That accounts for Daniel's 1260 days and 1290 days. And for the description of the Great Tribulation, when the woman flees to the wilderness, in Revelation, John said she will be in the wilderness for 1260 days. So we have a 30-day gap between 1260 and 1290. So I'm going to pull in prophecy that says that we're going to see some things at Passover, and I'm going to show you where the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah ties into Jerusalem, and it comes at that Purim and Passover season at some future year. In Genesis 18:14, Sarah had laughed. It was a laugh of derision, saying, "Surely will I bear a child? I am old." And in verse 14, he says, "Is anything too hard for Yahweh? At the time appointed, I will return to you according to the time of life, and Sarah will have a son." So the time appointed is Moed. So we know that there is a Moed, a feast of the Lord, a time appointed to the Lord that is going to happen, at which time, at that time, Sarah will have a son. So now let's go to Genesis 19:3, and it's where Lot was able to get the two men, the two angels that went to Sodom, and he got them into his house, and he made them a feast, a mishte, a banquet. But that banquet had unleavened bread. It had matzah. So I'm going to submit to you that there may be a reason why Lot would have served unleavened bread. I don't believe it was a coincidence that Lot served unleavened bread. I submit that this is the same time that would later become Passover. And why would Abraham and Lot be serving unleavened bread? Now, we don't, it says that they served in 18, Genesis 18, it says that Sarah served cakes. Let me go and see there. Where is it? It said that they were cakes, they were ash cakes, round cakes. And that word is uga. Now, if you live in the Middle East, you probably have had these cakes baked in these kilns. This bread may or may not have leaven in it. So here in 18, we don't know if Abraham was serving those kinds of, you know, unleavened cakes or not. But there in 19, Lot certainly is. Why was he doing that? Well, why would they even have had a cause to remember that time of year that would later, way later, hundreds of years later, would become Passover? Where would we have seen that before? Well, it would have been in Genesis 8, verses 3 and 4, when the waters returned from off the earth, and it was at the end of the 150 days when the ark rested on the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. The seventh month from the month which we call Tishrei, which is in the civil calendar, is month number one. That's the calendar that Noah would have used. Yahweh gave Aaron, later on, he gave Aaron the month of Nisan as the first month in which there would be the season of the feasts, the seven feasts from Nisan to Tishri. But in Noah's time, they were observing Tishri as the first month. So the seventh month, when the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat, the seventh month was Nisan. And the ark rested on the 17th day of the month, way into the future, about 2,000 years into the future. What happened on the 17th day of the month? Yeshua's resurrection. That was, you see, he went into the grave at the end of the 14th. Then we had the 15th and the 16th. And then he was resurrected. So that's the season of the Passover. Now here in Genesis 19:3, were they celebrating the day when Noah's ark rested on the mountains of Ararat? Well, it certainly is a possibility. And later on, we're going to find out that Passover was exactly 430 years after the birth of Isaac. So it's 430 years to the day, which is what it says there in, I have the scripture written down. Let me see if I have it here. Moses said it, 430 years to the day. And maybe because I've got my notes everywhere here. I'm going to see. Okay, I'm going to just look it up in my eSword because I can't find it in my notes. Okay, Exodus 12:41. It came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the self same day. So 430 years after something happens, it comes to pass that the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. That's Passover. I'm going to submit to you that the ark resting on mountains of Ararat happened at that time. Isaac was born a year later after the Lord visited Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre. That was at Passover. And that what happened here with Lot baking unleavened bread, that's all an ancient moed that Yah just built on. You understand? Any comments or questions about that? Because I have some other things I want to talk about.
Go.
Hey, Kimberly. That was awesome, because I've often looked at that and thought, now why are they pointing out that was unleavened bread? That's always, you know, I mean, it's made a point to say that they ate unleavened bread there. And I thought that, you know, I have it even underlined in my Bible, because I've often thought that is a time marker for something, you know, just, and how you just explained it was really nice. Thank you.
Joanne?
I guess my question is, could you say it again, how Tishrei became Nisan?
No, I didn't say Tishrei became Nisan. In Israel, there are four calendars, and two of them have to do with the civil calendar, starting at Tishrei 1, which is, you know, in the fall. That's where the fall feasts come in. The other calendar happens at Nisan, or Aviv, which is when Yahweh told Aaron, it is from this point that you're going to, you know, tell everybody when the feasts are. So if you're at Nisan and you go for the feasts, Tishrei is the seventh month. It's, you know, it's halfway through the year. So if you go from Tishrei, then Nisan becomes the seventh month, because you have, except for when you have the additional year when they put in the Adar Bet. But if you have the 12-year calendar, then that's what it is, 6 months and 6 months. Does that make sense?
It makes sense, I guess, because Genesis 8:3-4 says the seventh day of the 17th day of the seventh month. I like the 17th relating to the resurrection. I understand, but so far all the penny hasn't dropped, so I'm going to leave my question, because I do understand, and I do understand the difference between a civil calendar and, you know, and the objection to people saying Happy Rosh Hashanah and all the crazy stuff that goes on over calendars. So I'm not going there, but I'm going to review, and the penny will drop. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Okay, so now I want to talk about the promised son. And for that, we're going to need to go to 2 Kings chapter 4 and read starting at verse 8. That also is part of the Haftarah section, and we can just read that. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to go ahead and read it. Is everybody over there? Okay, I'm going to go ahead and start. And it fell on a day that Elisha went through Shunem, there where there was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat bread. And she said to her husband, "Behold now, I perceive that this is a holy man of God, which passes by us continually. Let us make a little chamber, I pray you, on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed and a table and a stool and a candlestick, and it shall be when he comes to us that he shall turn in there." And it fell on a day that he came there, and he turned into the chamber and lay there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call this Shunammite." And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, "Say now to her, 'Behold, you have been careful for us with all this care. What is to be done for you? Would you have me speak to the king or to the captain of the host?' And she answered, 'I dwell among my own people.' And he said, 'What then is to be done for her?' And Gehazi answered and he said, 'Verily, she has no child, and her husband is old.' And he said, 'Call her.' And when he had called her, she stood in the door. And he said, 'About this season, according to the time of life, you shall embrace a son.' And she said, 'No, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your handmaid.' And the woman conceived and bore a son at that season that Elisha had said to her, according to the time of life." Now, the next section is about what happens to the child. And it, in verse 18, "And when the child was grown, it fell on a day that he went out to his father to the reapers. And he said to his father, 'My head, my head.' And he said to a lad, 'Carry him to his mother.' And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon and died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door on him and went out. And she called to her husband and said, 'Send me, I pray you, one of the young men, and one of the asses, that I may run to the man of God and come again.' And he said, 'Where will you go to him today? It is neither new moon nor Sabbath.' And she said, 'It will be well.' Then she saddled an ass and said to her servant, 'Drive and go forward. Slack not your riding for me, except I bid you.' So she went and came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. And it came to pass, when the man of God saw her afar off, that he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Behold, here is that Shunammite woman. Run now, I pray you, to meet her and say to her, "Is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child?" And she answered, "It is well." And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught him by the feet, but Gehazi came near to thrust her away. And the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is vexed within her, and the Lord has hid it from me and has not told me." Then she said, "Did I desire a son of my Lord? Did I not say, 'Do not deceive me'?" Then he said to Gehazi, "Gird up your loins and take my staff in your hand and go your way. If you meet any man, salute him not. And if any salute you, answer him not again. And lay my staff upon the face of the child." And the mother of the child said, "As the Lord lives and as my soul lives, I will not leave you." And he arose and followed after her. And Gehazi passed on before them and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. Therefore he went again to meet him and told him, saying, "The child is not awaked." And when Elisha was come into the house, behold, the child was dead and laid on his bed. He went in therefore and shut the door upon the two of them and prayed to Yahweh. He went up and lay upon the child and put his mouth upon his mouth and his eyes upon his eyes and his hands upon his hands, and he stretched himself upon the child, and the flesh of the child waxed warm. Then he returned and walked in the house to and fro and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed 7 times. And the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite. So he called her. And when she was come into him, he said, take up your son. She went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground and took up her son and went out. So we have in the Torah portion the promised son and the death of the promised son in the story of Isaac. Now, the promised son comes to Sarah and Abraham. The promised son comes to the Shunammite woman, and the promised son comes to Mary. And then we have the promised son being taken and to be slain on Mount Moriah, which is Mount Zion. And instead of him being slain, God provides the lamb. But that is a type and shadow of the resurrection. And then we have this Shunammite woman who has a son, and it's the same words. What shall we do for her? And in the time of life, according to the time of life, you will embrace a son. And so this Shunammite woman, who was this Shunammite woman? Well, the city of Shunem was in the tribe of Issachar. And this was a wealthy woman, but she had no son, for her husband was old. Here we have the old husband, not necessarily that she was a young woman, but there's nothing said about her age, but here she is, she conceives a child of old age, and then this child dies, saying, my head, does that not sound like crown of thorns, crown of thorns? See, type and shadow. So the same thing that's happening here is going to happen to Yeshua. Mary has the promised son. That son dies. The father resurrects him. And then we're going to go to Luke 24. And in Luke 24, we're going to read where he tells them that these things needed to be explained to them in verse 44 from the law of Moses. What's part of the law of Moses? Genesis chapter 18, and again in 22, the binding of Isaac. And in the prophets, Elisha is a prophet. And of course, in the Psalms, we read of Yeshua all through the law and the prophets and the Psalms. He's in it, that everywhere. And then we don't get in the story of the Shunammite's son, how many days it took for her son to be resurrected. But in verse 46, we might get a hint that it might have been close to being the third day. Because remember, Mount Carmel and where she was in the territory of Issachar, there was a little distance. Not far, but some distance. Gehazi went there, and then Elisha followed, and perhaps on the second day or on the third day, who knows? I'm just submitting this for you to think about and pray about. Her son was resurrected, but on the third day it was that he said, it was written that the Messiah had to suffer and rise from the dead on the third day. Oh, by the way, on the third day is when Abraham looked up and he saw Mount Moriah. So we have this connection all through the Torah and the prophets, and in even in the Psalms, about the promised son. What a beautiful story. What a beautiful account of this great promise. The son that was promised to Abraham in Genesis 15. And then in Genesis 22, Yahweh says, you have not withheld your only son. That's what Yeshua is to Yahweh the Father, his only son. That's what I had to say to tie together the Torah portion, the Haftarah, and the Brit Hadashah. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Go ahead, Joanne.
I know that in the reading you declared that Sarah laughed in derision, and I'm not sure that derision is the attitude that she actually had. When Abraham laughed, his next question was about Ishmael. So he wasn't eternally minded when he was promised Isaac, even though eternity had been his and Yahweh's conversation for a long time. You know, your seed and everyone after you, and you're going to be blessed and the nations are going to be blessed. And yet he's still earthly minded with Ishmael. So we come to Sarah and she laughs. She laughs out of fear. I mean, that's why it had to be declared or had to be explained in our scriptures that she laughed out of fear, because that's what we would do if we were in her position. We would be afraid that that couldn't be true. We'd had a lifetime of childlessness. The Shunammite woman had a lifetime of childlessness, apparently, because that was the one thing she lacked. If she were a wealthy woman of Shunam, then the one thing she lacked was a child. So the two women fit together more neatly than a negative attitude of derision to me.
That's a good point. The word there is tzakok, and it can mean to mock. Yahweh, in Genesis 17:17, when Abraham fell on his face and laughed, or tzakok, Yahweh didn't say anything about him laughing. But here, Yahweh does say something about Sarah's laughing. And some people take that, and I also take it, but I understand what you're saying. I also take it that her laughter was more of a mock than Abraham's. So that's why I say that, but I also see what you're saying. Any other, do you want to answer back about that, Joanne?
We go forward to Zechariah, who is taking his turn in the temple, and he asks the question, how will I know this to be true? And he gets to be mute until the child is born, John the Baptist. And the Shunammite woman says, oh, man of God, don't lie to your servant. So there's reactions when these promises come that are out of bounds of the natural course of events. And it has to do with barrenness, and it has to do with whatever is in your heart that builds up. So, again, not a huge consequence point, but they do tie together. And when we come forward to our own hearts, we have to know that we believe God over our circumstances also, because nothing is too hard for him. And I'm in America and you're in Jordan, and I'd rather be in Jordan in many ways. And all of those things, you know, it's there's seasons and all of the moeds and all of that, of course, is what we're talking about. But we have to apply it to our own heart and what our own attitudes are when God makes outrageous promises that we don't see how they're going to be fulfilled.
Yes, that's good. Shelby?
I was thinking, too, I know that you found the Hebrew word, and it was talking about meaning mock, but I kind of was having, like, a thought about maybe... Because I was thinking, well, what do we do when we doubt something? Like, usually we're like, oh, no way. Like, no, that's not going to happen. You know, like, when we doubt something, we almost do get that attitude of, like, mocking.
Well, the disciples also, it says that, you know, they were, let's go over there. There's a, I can't get that what you're saying. Hang on a second. Luke 24. Because they were doing. Let me see if I can find it. Okay. They were terrified and affrighted. But then, oh, in verse 41, it says, while they yet believed not for joy and wondered, like, you know, like we say today, I can't believe it, you know, that kind of thing. He asked them for something to eat. I find that a little bit of humor, like they're running around saying, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. And they're all joyous and having wonder about it. And then he just very quietly says, you have anything to eat? You got any meat? So yeah, I get it. So those are good points. I want to talk, though, about something else in 2 Kings 4 about this Shunammite woman. In verse 13, that hospitality played a large part in the story of the promised sons. Abraham was giving hospitality to Yahweh himself, and the Shunammite woman was giving hospitality to the representative of Yahweh, Elisha. So it's a big deal for us to be hospitable. And one of the things I noticed about the people that we are here with, where we're at, they are extremely hospitable. So this is a big reason why Yahweh does great things for people, is because of their hospitality. Any questions? Okay.
I don't have a question about that exactly. It ties in with last week's Torah portion, however. In the beginning of this week, Abraham looks up, he raised his eyes and looked, there in front of him stood three men. So if you're going to look up in that word, Nasa, Hebrew 5:3-7:5, if you're going to look up in that word, in that context, it is a spiritual sight. It's not just your natural eyes. So he had to have noticed the three men. One was Yeshua appearing to him. It says Yahweh appeared, but we'll not go with that in a second. I wanted to bring that to Sodom and Gomorrah when he looks and sees the smoke rising like a smoking furnace. And last week, you said that the distinction of when Abraham and Yahweh were having that moment where Abraham was asleep and a smoking furnace and a burning torch were walking between the pieces, you brought out the Mount Sinai and the smoke on that mountain. And you said it's when Yeshua comes from the throne, so that the smoking furnace was likely to be Yeshua. So if Abraham has spiritual eyes to look up, then he looks up and sees the smoke of Sodom and Gomorrah. He must be looking up to see that Yahweh, Yeshua, has come to do something on the earth. And then later, as you pointed out, he looks up, that same Nasa, he looks up and sees Mount Moriah, which is going to be is that going to be Jerusalem? Is Mount Moriah the place where Jerusalem is? I guess is my statement and my question.
Yeah, that's the, yes, Mount Moriah is also the mountain of the temple, the mountain of the house, and it's now where Jerusalem is, yes.
So Abraham is looking up in three different times and sees the future, basically. And yet, as you were saying, in the between the pieces, he was asleep, but the between the pieces was the link to what he's seeing now, the smoke.
Yeah, I can see that. That's a good point. Anybody else?
Hi there.
Hi there.
Can I go back to the Genesis portion?
Yeah.
I wanted to comment earlier, but as we are all coming to learn, I have a bit of a defect with regard to my ability to get to the button quickly.
That's okay.
So there were a handful of things that stuck out to me. Some things I want to comment on and some things I have questions on. First, Sodom and Gomorrah. That's a story we're all familiar with, and you know, we all know why God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. It's interesting. Many years ago, I found myself talking with someone advocating for homosexuality within Christianity. And they said that, in Ezekiel, we see the real reason that God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. And it wasn't because of homosexuality. And so they turned to Ezekiel 16, verses 49 and 50. And there it says, and now this is the homosexual church, which, believe it or not, is semi-evangelical. 16:49-50 says, "Now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters were arrogant, overfed, and unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did detestable things before me. Therefore, I did away with them, as you have seen." So they say that the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah was arrogance, overfed, unconcerned, and they didn't help the poor and the needy. And that's why God judged Sodom and Gomorrah. And I only bring that up because when I was introduced to that, I was completely shocked and dumbfounded. And if I introduce it here, you know, we're in a time where, gosh, I thought we're at a time 10 years ago when I first was introduced to this, that homosexuality was on the rise. Oh my gosh, look at it now. So I just throw that out here to say, well, we should be aware of this because someone can confront us to this, confront us with this Ezekiel passage. And, well, yes, this is a problem, you know, the haughtiness and the overfed and the unconcerned, but let's not neglect what we see here in Genesis 18 or 19 as to why God judged them. It was also because of this just horrific incident.
Yes. Do you want me to reply right now or wait?
You don't have to, but you can. I was going to go on to something else, but if you have something to say about that, please.
Well, Yahweh told Abraham that he was going to check out the outcry that had come to him. And the outcry has to do with justice and injustice. And in the book of Jasher, you have to read how they would really harm people significantly and kill, even cause people death through someone. I'm trying to think where I read that there was an incident in Sodom where they just raped a woman to death. I mean, that kind of outcry was happening. And, you know, a traveler came through Sodom and he needed something. And they you know, hurt him, they robbed him, they did all these things to him. Those kinds of things are the outcry. But we need to understand that it does have to do with homosexuality as well, I think.
Yeah. Well, and then I've always been puzzled by Lot, you know, righteous Lot, as he's called in the New Testament, offering his daughters to these men. That's just like unfathomable to me and to us in general here in these days. Any thoughts on that?
Well, my thought on it this year.
Okay, that's fair.
My thought on it this year was him offering those girls to those men, knowing that both of them were going to be killed by being raped all night, had to have a spiritual, a psychological effect on them to the point where it broke down all of their inhibitions. Yeah. About, you know, how they would get children.
Wow. And that ties in to something when I first, Michelle and I first came on at something 58, I think it was Shelby was, you know, we came in the middle of something Shelby was saying. She was talking about, I think, a book that what the authors or the book addressed, you know, one of the things, people that have been counseling for trauma and something like that. Well, talk about trauma, having your father offer you up to these sex-crazed people at your door. That's trauma for sure.
Yeah.
And then okay. My other comment was, you know, Lot and his daughters, they gave him some wine. That must have been a boatload of wine for him to be so drunk to not understand what was going on. My gosh.
Well, the alcohol content was very high in that first glass, you know.
I mean, that's, again, that's just another something that's just unfathomable to me.
Yes, I know. I have the same reaction, Mark. It's like, really? I have been drunk a couple of times in my life, and I still kind of I knew what was happening around me.
Yeah, but then I think the point a big part of the point of that passage is that, you know, it was that sinful, awful, horrible, unfathomable thing that resulted in the birth of the nations of the Moabites and the Ammonites.
Yes.
Then another thing.
And let me interject here, because incest might have been another sexual component of Sodom and Gomorrah and those cities of the region. And Joanne, did you have something you wanted to comment about Mark's comment?
Well, verse 34 in chapter 19, during this incestuous bargain with the sisters, they're saying, we'll enable our father to have descendants. So they're taking credit for giving life to, I mean, it's just, it's a big mess. And the Moabites and the Ammonites have favor with God to this day as far as the, excuse me, as far as the land mass. Is that true? The what went forward for the land of Moab and Ammon?
The territories that still exist today, or is that what you mean, Joanne?
Sorry, I was coughing. The land grant, our inheritance, Israel's inheritance, Moab and Ammon have a piece of that, don't they?
No.
No, okay.
No. The Israel, Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh's territory is north of Ammon or Ammon.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Go ahead, Mark.
So, as a part of that whole mess, what was just brought out is those young women, they were trying to extend their father's name and to continue his honor. And I mean, something that just came to mind as that was brought up now. How important it is for us to have the Word of God to help us discern what's right and wrong. You know, and so these women were doing something that they just thought was right. And, you know, the way it's presented, well, their hearts were right. It's like, so it's just completely wrong.
Yes, that's what marks our flesh. We can have good intentions, but mm-hmm. if it's not done Yahweh's way, then, you know, it's sinful. It's sin.
Yeah, we're just doing what's right in our own eyes.
Right.
That's kind of like what happened with Abimelech, too. Like, I think it was Abimelech when he was like, wait a minute, I had good intentions. And then Yahweh was like, I know, that's why I want you to give Sarah back to Abraham, because you need to slow your roll.
Yeah. Well, and then that's another one of my questions. You know, is this chapter, excuse me, with Abimelech way out of order? Because, you know, Sarah, if this chapter is in order, she's an 80-year-old woman or so at this time. And, you know, what king or anybody, no offense to those of us that are, you know, no longer 20, is interested in an 80-year-old woman? You know, I mean, I assume he has a harem and he has wives already. Sarah must have been really beautiful to, at 80 years old, be attractive to this king, Abimelech.
Well, the Jewish commentaries say that Yahweh restored her beauty to a time when she was younger. And, you know, I can understand that. Because as women age, their female hormones decline, and it's the female hormones that give them the good skin and, you know, all of that. So yeah. if her female hormones shot up so that she could conceive, she may well have been, she may have gone back to being really an attractive woman. And also the Jewish commentaries say that she was extraordinarily beautiful to begin with. So, and I've seen many women in older age that were really still very beautiful.
Yeah.
They weren't moving fast.
They weren't moving fast. Michelle said they weren't moving fast.
Well, when they're 80, you're not. I could say, okay, she could be beautiful, but I don't know. Just 80s. I believe what the word says. It's true, but it's just, it's hard to get your mind around it.
Well, she was been 90. She was 10 years younger than Abraham, I believe. So she would even was older than what we're even talking about. Go ahead, Joanne.
Sarah, to have a baby at 90 and be able to nurse that baby for 3 years, we're talking excellent hormones. But Abimelech or Abraham, that in that culture, in that society, there were always alliances, politics, and so forth. So it may not always have been the beauty of the woman, but the advantage it would give you to the man, the brother, he thought the brother of this woman, to make a political alliance. So some of that is a little vague.
You know what? That is a very good point. That's a very good point because you're right. In those days, and still it's the same today, you know, we still have that on the earth of the political marriages. We have it in the Congress of the United States. So that is an excellent point, Joanne. Thank you.
So I have one more thing. I hope I'm not monopolizing too much here.
No, not at all.
Okay. And it is in Genesis 21, from 22 through the end of the chapter. Now Abimelech and Phicol come to Abraham and they want to do a treaty. And then Abraham says, hey, wait, in verse 25, he complained to him about Abimelech about a well of water that Abimelech's servants had seized. And Abimelech said, well, I don't know who's done this. You didn't tell me about it. I've only heard about it now. So anyway, so they get into a treaty. And, you know, verse 30, accept these seven lambs as a witness. So they called the place Beersheba. Then at verse 32, after the treaty had been made at Beersheba, Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his forces, returned to the place they're from, it seems, the land of the Philistines. So here's Abimelech and Phicol, they're Philistines. They're with Abraham. Already at the time of Abraham, Abraham and the Philistines are having problems because the Philistines are messing with Abraham's property, his wells. Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. But the other thing I want to bring out is the Philistines of today, again, as some of us know, the English word for Philistine is Palestine.
Right.
The Philistines are Palestinians. Palestinians today are embracing the identity of the enemies of Israel from of old. And so, you know, people can talk about how, well, Ishmaelites come from Abraham, so maybe some way, somehow, there's some promise in there. Esau, the people that say they're of Esau, well, that came from Abraham's loins, so maybe there's something there. And I think I talked about that last week in the Torah study last time. You know, because the chosen lineage is not through Ishmael, it's not through Esau, we know this. But here we see the Philistines are arguing with Abraham, and there's no way that you can say that the Philistines of old, at least, have any relationship to Abraham physically. There's no DNA relationship, because right here we see the Philistines are arguing with Abraham. They did not descend from him in any way, shape, or form. So the Philistines of today, they call themselves Palestinians. Again, in Arabic, the word for Palestinian is Philistini. So, you know, they've embraced that identity. In doing so, I think they cut off any shred of hope, in this at least, of being related or some way from Abraham's loins in his DNA. So I just want to bring that out. You know, that's just kind of contemporary. Understanding that the Philistines today are not the descendants of the Philistines of the Bible, there probably is a lot of Ephraimite blood in the Philistines of today. But what they're doing politically and identifying with the Philistines, that does a lot to cut them off. So those are my comments.
Okay, well, you know, it's interesting that you bring up about the, there is a verse, Genesis 10:14, where we have the word plishti or plishtim, it says there, the plural, who came from Akasluhim. Akasluhim is a son of Mitzrayim, who is a son of Ham. Mitzrayim is Egypt, as you know, and these Pelishtim in Genesis 10:14 are the forerunners of the Philistines. So these are by blood enemies of Shem, because they come from Ham. The sons of Ham are Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And then you come down here to Mizraim, who begat Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, and Naphtahim, and Pathrusim, and Kasluhim. And out of Kasluhim comes the Philistine. And that word is Strong's H6430, and it's the word for Palestine or Philistine. It's where we get that word Philistine and those people from Ham. But I am on your page because I have read the genome study. And the genome study of the people that now call themselves wrongly, because the British followed in the Roman footsteps, calling Israel, the whole of Israel, Palestine, from Philistine. That genome study says that 61% of the people in the West Bank, and they tested almost 1 million people there, 61% of those have Jewish blood, they said. Now, scientists, they have no interest in Bible history. They're not going to, everything, you know, that the Jews say the whole land belongs to them. All the Bible belongs to them except for the New Testament. Everything belongs to the Jews. We know the Jews are four tribes, but we know that Israel is 12 tribes. And if you read the histories of in the scriptures and the histories written by men that conquered Israel, men like Sennacherib and so forth, you will find out that the people that are now being called Palestinians in the West Bank are from all 12 tribes. They're not from Judah. They're not from just Benjamin or Levi or Simeon. They are from all 12 tribes. So Mark, you are absolutely right. The majority of those people are from Jacob. They don't know their own identity. Any other comments or questions? I like your comment.
How did that happen? Like the, how did that, like, cause they were originally all, from the blood of, what did you say? The Pathrusim. Like how over time, I know it's like uncovering thousands of years of history, but now they're mostly Jacob. So how did that happen?
There was David, who reigned over a united kingdom. Then came Solomon, who disobeyed Yahweh and got the people pulled into idolatry. Now, Yahweh had told Solomon, if you will obey me, I will establish your throne. But Solomon did not obey, so Solomon does not get an established throne. David gets an established throne, but after Solomon, there was Solomon's son, Rehoboam. And Rehoboam lost all but 10 tribes. It was prophesied by Abijah, the prophet, to Jeroboam that Yahweh was going to give 10 of the 12 tribes to Rehoboam. And in the time of Rehoboam, that's exactly what happened. Shortly after Rehoboam took the throne, Jeroboam went to see Rehoboam to ask him to relax the temple taxes that were being taken from the people countrywide. And Rehoboam said, no way, nothing doing. In fact, I'm going to make it worse on you. I'm going to tax you even more than my father did. So the 10 northern tribes split off from the United Kingdom. Now, after that happened, there was no righteous king of Israel. There were righteous kings in Judah, but no righteous king of Israel. And the Lord decided to destroy and scatter the northern house called the house of Israel. But not all of the people were taken captive by the nations that came in, Babylon and Assyria and so forth. Assyria came in first. There were always people left in the northern areas. We read about Hezekiah later on, a king of Judah, reaching out to the people that were left in the northern territories of Ephraim and Manasseh, Zebulun, and so forth. Come back to Jerusalem so that Yahweh will soften the hearts of their captors. I think that's in 2 Chronicles 30. Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah. He wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh. Come back to Passover. And some of the people did, some of the people didn't. But nonetheless, that tells us that even after the Assyrian captivity, there were people left. The writings are, I'm going to rephrase that. There were people left in the northern territory that belonged to Jacob. But the writings, even in the scriptures and the historical and archaeological writings, tell us that as the various empires came in, what they did was they would round them up, you know, like the United States did. They rounded up the Indians and they moved them onto reservations. Well, the United States is an Ephraimite nation to begin with. And they just followed the pattern of their Assyrian captors back there in the Middle East. They just rounded up the Indians and put them on the reservations. They had learned that from Sennacherib and the kings and generals that came after Sennacherib, where they just rounded up the people from the tribal territories. Even Dan is mentioned there in 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And Zebulun is mentioned there as well. And they put them in a reservation in and around Samaria, which is in the West Bank, what we call the West Bank today. And in those areas, those evil kings and generals also settled Gentiles. So you have a genome in the West Bank of people who call themselves Philistine, or Palestinians rather, Philistines, who are 61% of the population is from Jacob. 16% are Edomites. There's a population that's from Moab. There's even a Roman contingent in that genome study. And even though Edom makes up, the Edomites make up 16%, there's also an Italian component from Rome of people there. So it's a mixture of Jacobites and Gentiles there. And the Palestinians practice two religions, Islam and Christianity. So those are our brethren, and they need our prayers as much as do the Jews. They need our prayers. And so in the East and in the Middle East, rather, in the Middle East, we have Jacob practicing Islam and Christianity, and then Judaism comes in. And in the West, we have Christianity and Judaism, and then Islam comes in. Isn't that interesting? But I hope that answered your question, Shelby.
Yeah, it did. So did the Native Americans, because they were here, and they have, like, I don't really know what they do. They do, like, sweat lodges, and they do, like, animal worship or whatever. Did all that stuff come from captivity as well? Like, where did that come from, like, Egypt? I don't know. I guess I'm confused with that.
I have not studied the genome of the American Native Americans. The Cherokee made the claim that they were Hebrews, ancient Hebrews, but when the genome study came out that they did, they found only a small percentage of Hebrew DNA in them. I have not studied the Native American genome, so I really don't know where they came from. They came, according to some historians, across the Bering Strait, which is the land bridge between Russia and the United States, or Russia and North America, let me say it that way. But beyond that, I really don't know anything about them, because my focus has been on the Middle East, on Israel, on the fighting between the two houses, and really my focus is Jerusalem centric.
So would they, if they came from Russia, they'd probably have more Edomite DNA.
Well, yeah, Edomite, Assyrian, because and other, you know, Babylonian, you know, anything, any people that were in the Middle Eastern area, when there was dispersion, they went to the north into Russia. And today, Iran, who is, you know, has an Edomite contingent through Haman of, you know, the Esther story. So he was an Edomite. And then you have in the southwest corner of Iran, you have a community of ancient Assyrians, and they still call themselves ancient Assyrians. And they have, I think it's 4 seats in the Iranian parliament. If you look between Iran, the Persians, and you look up into Russia, you'll see that there is a huge relationship between Russia and Persia from way back when. Their borders are porous. People go back and forth, or they had been anyway, as late as the late 19th century. And I mean, their construction is the same. They have the same kind of facial features. They're brothers. So when Greece came in and conquered Persia, a lot of those Persians went north into Russia. So, I mean, but the historians say that the Native Americans migrated into North America from Russia 10,000 years ago. So I haven't really studied that to know what the latest information is from those disciplines, you know, archaeology and history, paleontology and so forth. I don't really know. I can't really answer your question on that. Go ahead, Joanne.
I mean, I guess I have glanced at the dispersion and the travel routes that got taken out of the North Territory of Israel, but I think that's kind of exciting to think that there were trade routes somewhere back there that enabled people to leave Russia. And I don't have a dog in that fight that the Native Americans have any of Jacob's blood, but Yeshua certainly knows, and they certainly are here as much as we are.
Yes, exactly. Go ahead, Shelby, you had another comment.
Oh, I was just gonna thank you. And the reason why I asked was because I always found their culture very interesting, and so I was interested on how related they are Bible, you know, for Yeshua, if they have any of that, and if they're just very confused on, because I don't know what they, how they worship, whatever they worship, but I think obviously anyone can repent and turn to the Creator. But I had seen a video somewhere of a guy, he was kind of talking about how, I don't remember, I feel like he was talking about Cherokee, but how they were finding their roots back into Hebrew, and that they were finding the Creator again. So that's why I asked, because I thought it, the history is very interesting, and this guy was talking about how he found Yeshua. So that's why I asked.
Yeah, that's it was an interesting thing about the Cherokee, because they in their territory, in their ancient territory, there were found some rocks that had old ancient Hebrew on it, Paleo Hebrew, I think. I might be wrong about that, but there was Hebrew. Somebody had carved Hebrew into this rock, and the Cherokee were shown to have some cultural tendencies that looked like Hebrew things that they would do. But, you know, years ago, many years ago, almost two decades ago, I think now, I was watching a PBS special about the Mayans. And the Mayans have a writing called the Popol Vuh. And in the Popol Vuh, what caught my attention was that they talked about the sons of Solomon and the sons of Abraham that came, and that they were there with the Mayans. I'm trying to remember from this long ago, but these people did not marry into the Mayan culture, but they certainly brought Hebrew to the Mayan culture, the biblical understanding of the how to live during the days of Solomon. And I found that very interesting, and I went and got a copy of the Popol Vuh, and sure enough, there was a mention of Abraham and Solomon in there, and the sons of, either the sons of Solomon or the sons of, I think it was the sons of Abraham. And it appeared to me that these were probably from the tribe of Dan, because if I remember correctly, they were tall and blonde, tall, you know, very light-haired, like the tribe of Dan. So the ancient Israelites were all over the place in ancient times. So That doesn't mean that they necessarily left their DNA behind, because even Gog, the Reubenite son of Joel, in 1 Chronicles 5, 4, for ages and ages, when they migrated north, one of the things that baffles people that study those ancient cultures is that they did not intermarry with the cultures around them. That is a distinctly Israelite practice. So I can see where the Cherokee would say, well, this stone here has Hebrew on it. We have some customs that look like ancient Israelite customs. We must be related. But it doesn't matter, because they come to salvation the way that everyone else does, through Yeshua. Adam came to salvation through Yeshua. So did Abraham, so did David, so did everyone. So that's where we need to keep our focus, is on Yeshua and the salvation that he brings. Go ahead, Joanne.
I love hearing this story over and over again, because when Jeroboam and Rehoboam, all of that day and age and what happened, I love Yaakov's study of the kings, because it really goes into that history and that time so thoroughly. But I do also, have read testimonies from missionaries who have gone to places that, I don't know, I can't be specific right now, but the story of a father and a son and a sacrifice seems to have gone through all cultures. So we know that in the creation, God has left his stamp, his DNA, his way of doing things in all of these cultures. And it is for the individual to come by way of Yeshua, as you so pointed out from time in the beginning. I guess in reading cultural things, ancient Near East treaties, land grants, all those things, there are things in common. And I think a lot of the commonality was to help the children of Jacob understand what was going on, because it was the culture they lived in. And if it hadn't gone on around them, it might have been so foreign to them that they really, really couldn't keep up. So just ancient Near East has been a fascination in general to me.
Well, and the ancient Near East context and culture, Joanne, you're so right on the money, because if we don't understand the context in which the Bible was written and understand those cultures, we miss so much understanding of why people did what they did, which looks to us like, well, what was going on there? No matter what you're reading, you can find a question about why was that, you know? So you're absolutely right. I encourage people to study the history of the kings of Israel and the prophets that were prophesying during each of those kings' reigns. And you're right, Yaakov did an excellent job on that. And for those who are hearing this recording, you can get that those teachings at tabernacleofdavidrestored.com, and listen to all of those teachings that Yaakov did. They're excellent. So yes, we have to know the ancient Near East context. You are absolutely right. The Lord always works from where we are, but at the end of days, we also have to point ourselves back to where that culture was, because that's the culture from which the Bible was written. Mark, will you pray for us and we'll end our meeting?
Gladly. Father, we love you. We praise you. You are so good. You are worthy, O Lord. Thank you for this time together in your presence and learning of you from your word, from each other. We offer you our lives again, even now, and say, have your way with us now and in the rest of this week.
Yes.
In Yeshua's holy name. Amen.
Okay. Well, everybody, you have a wonderful week. And Shelby and Joanne, you have a good Shabbat, the rest of your Shabbat days.
Yes.
Ours is over. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom, everybody.
Shabbat shalom.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.